First of all, thanks everyone for joining. This is the Ascend Radio live series, and today I'm excited to be joined by Kieran Walsh. Kieran Walsh is a professor of health policy and management at Manchester Business School. He's been a leading researcher in healthcare for over three decades, exploring the intersection of research, policy, and practice to engage with policy and practitioner communities and to put ideas into action. And putting ideas into action is right at the heart of what we'll be discussing today. So, Kieran, thank you once again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. And pleased to take up the invite. Thank you, Paul.
Excellent. As you know, I have a few questions, but certainly if we want to go beyond that, or if the conversation takes us off route, the better. So I want to start by briefly going into your background a bit about your history and regulation and research. Can you give us an idea of how your career got started and how that's led you to your current role?
Yeah, sure. So I began my career after university as an NHS manager, a manager in our healthcare system in the UK. And quickly realized I didn't really want to be a chief executive, and I was really interested in the data, the ideas and so on. So I went to work at the King's Fund, which is a kind of health policy think tank in London, and began to do mostly work around quality and performance in healthcare, and then moved into academia, moved to Birmingham University, spent a year in the US at UC Berkeley as a Harkness Fellow, came back, and I've worked at Manchester for about 20-something years now. And my sort of interests as a researcher, I'm a social scientist, basically, and my interests as a researcher are mostly to do with quality and safety in healthcare, measuring performance, clinical governance. I've done quite a bit of work around inquiries and investigations into failures in care, and the sort of two enduring interests for me in regulation have been both professional regulation, mostly to do with the medical workforce, and organizational regulation, the arrangements we have for inspection and oversight of healthcare providers. I've done that, but I'm the kind of academic who likes to get out of the university. So I have spent some time as a board member of, I'm currently a board member of a large healthcare provider, but I've been a board member of the what is now the Professional Standards Authority, which is the body the statutory body that oversees the nine healthcare professions regulators in the UK. And I've done work with Parliament and lots of work with regulators. Because I think, you know, if you're a researcher, it's all very well sitting in your office writing papers for journals and so on. But if you want to have some influence and get things done, you need to get out there. And that's why I love doing, you know, seminars like this with people who work in regulation.
And speaking of getting out there, you certainly got out there earlier this year at CLEAR's conference in Dublin in May, where you presented a chat very much along the lines of what we'll be discussing today. I really enjoyed your conversation. And there you called on regulators to make of themselves researchers. I'm paraphrasing you a little bit. And I want to get into that a bit. Yeah. Can we begin by discussing how you first came around to this idea that regulators ought to establish and deepen their research capabilities?
Sure. I think it's through doing lots of research with regulators and realizing that whilst there are times when regulators need kind of external support to do good research, and sometimes that externality and independence can actually be really valuable, what really helps is if regulators have what I'd call a kind of evaluation mindset in their approach. And that does usually mean that they've got people in the regulator who think about and know something about evaluation methods and tools and techniques. I think there's two advantages to that, at least. One is kind of getting upstream. So often academics like me get commissioned to evaluate something and do some research on a new regulatory program, for example, a new system of inspection. And when we get commissioned, the thing we're evaluating has already been designed. You know, in a sense, what we're doing is after the fact measuring how it worked. And you kind of want to get more upstream and have more influence for the research and evidence in the design to make it, you know, to maximize the chance it's going to be effective and to maximize learning from what has gone before. And that works more if the researcher, if the regulator has some embedded capacity. I suppose the other thing I'd say is that I think what we know about research on regulation and on regulatory activities is the answer to whether it works is often quite contingent, quite dependent on context. So that means that you can't simply say, well, you know, this particular thing in regulation worked in the US and we can take it and move it to the UK, or this worked with the medical workforce and the medical regulator, so we can just straightforwardly adapt that and use it in other professional groups. You're usually needing to adapt and wanting to design the way you implement the thing, the innovation, in a way that incorporates some evaluation. You know, I tend to say, you know, if regulators are going to spend a lot of money and resource on doing something new, they should try really hard to build in some evaluation and some to almost to make the innovation what you can call auto-evaluative. In other words, it's evaluation is kind of embedded in the way you do that innovation. So I might talk later about the work we've done with our Care Quality Commission on their model for inspection. But, you know, what you can do is build into that new model some things that help you to understand whether it works. And that's just great, because it means you get formative data from the early implementation that helps you to revise it and change it and incorporate it. None of that underplays, you know, the fact that doing that in practice can be a lot harder than saying it in theory because of the nature of the pressures on regulators.
Yeah, that's fair. So let's take that a little bit further. Why do you think regulators need to have in-house research capabilities, and how do you think they will benefit from it?
I think that they'll do better reforms and innovations in regulation if they have in-house capacity. And when they commission people like me from universities or consultancies to do work, they'll be better commissioners of that research because they understand what they're buying. But I also think that it's good for regulators to have somebody in the regulator who's horizon scanning, who's looking out there at what other people are doing, looking at the field of research, reading journals like Regulation and Governance and the Journal of Professional Regulation and so on, and bringing that back into the organisation. So that's why I think an in-house capacity, which doesn't have to be huge, and obviously is very dependent on the size of the regulator itself, has a lot of value.
So zooming that out a bit, perhaps even more importantly, how may the public at large benefit from improved, you know, from research conducted by regulators by way of improved public protection?
I think two things possibly. One is straightforwardly, if you get better regulatory reform and more impactful regulation that delivers what we intended it to do, that benefits the primary purpose of public protection. But I also think if regulators can demonstrate that they've thought really hard about what they're doing, they're more likely to command public confidence. So if they can explain their approach to regulation, which sometimes can you know, be very contested, and there are people out there in the media, in the press, who will say, oh, it's a terrible burden of regulation. Well, if you've costed it properly, and if you can present some data that tells you what it costs, well, actually, that gives you a really useful basis of evidence to bring into those public debates.
Yeah, that's fair. You know, your depth of expertise and experience is around healthcare research, as we've established. As we know, no discipline in regulation is an island, and one domain invariably impacts the other. So to that end, is regulatory learning by way of research transferable across regulatory domains in your view? And in what ways, if so?
So I think it is, and that one of the issues is that regulators are often somewhat siloed in their own sectors. So, you know, schools regulators talk to schools regulators, and medical regulators talk to medical regulators, and so on. I think it's transferable in two ways. Sometimes there are methods, if you like, regulatory tools, which we can see have been used in another setting and learn something from that. And the example I'd give of that in the UK is that we've had for quite a long time a very powerful and well established schools regulator, the Office for Standards in Education, which inspects all state schools and some independent schools. And actually Ofsted, that's what they're called, Ofsted, have been pretty good at having internal research capacity and doing lots of research. They've also been, their role has been highly controversial and quite political at times, partly because of that, perhaps they have done a lot of research. If you're interested in inspection in other domains, like inspection in social care of nursing homes and care homes, or inspection in hospitals, or indeed inspection in local authorities or in public housing associations, I think there's a lot to learn from that literature elsewhere. So that's one way you can do it. The other thing that I think is quite transferable is theory. So one of the things that I think, there's that old saying, there's nothing as practical as a good theory. So if you take, for example, the theories around responsive and proportionate regulation, those have been worked up and used in areas like environmental regulation, in occupational health and safety regulation, but they've come across and been used in healthcare regulation and in schools regulation and elsewhere. So I think that theory is really highly transferable and useful.
We'll get to real world in a little bit later in the conversation, but conceptually, can you provide a hypothetical case that may help illustrate the value of in-house research capabilities that they may have for the regulator and for the public at large?
I don't know about a hypothetical case. I suppose I'd point to the real case. In the UK, of the 9 professional regulators, the one that has the largest in-house capacity is the General Medical Council, which regulates doctors. And that's partly because they're the largest and best funded regulator, so they've got the most resources. And I think they've done a really good job of having their internal data and research function, which both does things like their annual reviews of the state of medical education, but also does deep dives into particular topics. So one of the topics that I've been doing research on in the last 2 or 3 years, has been locum doctors. In other words, doctors who work temporarily in a given organization for anything from, you know, a day or a couple of days, perhaps up to, you know, several months. And the has used its resources because it's got the professional register, it knows where all the doctors have prescribed connections, it's got lots of data from surveys. So it's used that data, I think, really well to bring together what it knows about locum doctors. So that's a real example, not a hypothetical one.
Yeah, well, along those lines, can you share any other real world examples of where a regulator has conducted in-house research that has translated into real impact, either by reshaping regulatory action on their behalf or by recalibrating policy more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, let me give an example that's both kind of in-house and out-of-house, if you like. I could give 2 examples, one of which is where the research gives some findings and the regulator doesn't do what the research suggests, and was both of them for me would relate to the Care Quality Commission, who, as I mentioned, they regulate all health and social care providers in England. We've done quite a bit of research work with them, and they have an internal team who I think do some great internal work. Some of our research with them looked at whether you can use data to predict which organisations you ought to inspect or take some further regulatory action with. And we did that work in several fields. We looked at accident and emergency departments, so EDs. We looked at maternity services. We looked at primary care. In all those areas, CQC had a kind of suite of data indicators, what they called intelligent monitoring. And so what we did was to say, well, do these intelligent monitoring indicators predict, or can they be used to predict, the ratings that organizations will get when they actually get inspected? And the answer in all 3 sectors is no. What the research did was highlight it's really hard to use predictive data to either decide who you're going to inspect or when you're going to inspect, or indeed what you're going to look at when you do an inspection. Despite that, CQC has kind of, they're now on a new version of intelligent monitoring called CQC insight, but they're still pursuing the idea of intelligence-led inspection, the idea that you can have a data set in advance that helps you to decide where you're going to inspect. I think the research evidence from our studies and also from others say that's really hard to do, even in quite small organizations. And in large organizations, like big acute hospitals, it's really hard to do. And there are a bunch of reasons why I think it's difficult. But that's an example where I think, you know, our research said a set of things and they've chosen to not really buy into what the research found. Another example, though, with CQC was we did some work with them on measuring impact from their regulatory regime. And I think what really highlighted was that the thinking they had initially was very much focused on inspection and what happened after inspection. So, you know, we go and inspect a given hospital, we produce a report and a rating, there are some recommendations there, does the hospital do those recommendations? And we came up with an impact framework, which suggested that's just one of about seven ways in which their regulatory regime impacts on the quality of care. For example, when they publish their inspection handbook, organizations respond to that by doing internal inspections. So before they ever get a formal inspection from CQC, they've actually done a lot of work to embed that inspection framework in their thinking and their work in preparation. So if you just measure, you know, what happens after inspection, you're not seeing all of that impact. Another example would be that organizations use internally the things CQC says to organizations are used internally by the organizations to get things to happen. So, you know, what you will see when you interview people is they say, you know, the quality manager says, well, CQC now says we have to have a pain management policy. And if they come and inspect us and we haven't got one, then that will be bad. So we need to do this. So CQC's standards and policies actually give particular interests in the organization leverage to get things done, which might be more difficult, particularly sometimes with, you know, groups of staff who are a bit hard to persuade to to manage. And CQC sort of changes the balance of power within the organization. So and we come up with this framework about seven or eight different ways in which CQC, what's been really good about that is that we've seen CQC then adopting that and using it in its own internal work. Recently, they were going out to commission some work, and I know they're using the framework as part of that. And that's really kind of encouraging, because I think our piece of work there did change their thinking. And, you know, I suppose I'd summarize it as saying there's a lot more to regulation than inspection, and a lot more to regulatory impact than the impact of inspection. I think that was a plus.
That was a bit of paradigm shift for CQC. How would you contrast the outcome of that against their approach beforehand?
I think that the challenge, I often say to people when I'm talking to regulators, I say the risk is that the process becomes the purpose. So you've got a regulatory purpose, which is to improve the quality and safety of care, but perhaps particularly to address poor quality care. But your process is all about doing inspections or registrations. And if you're not careful as a regulator, that process becomes the thing you measure yourself by. How many inspections have we done? How many enforcement notices have we issued? How many new registrations have we refused or whatever? And I think that's I think part of what you kind of want to do with the regulators, get them to step back from the process, which is all consuming, because, you know, when you produce your annual report, you're often describing what you've done, the activities you've done. Step back from that and think about its impact. I don't know whether I'd be as grand as to call it a paradigm shift, but I do think that's where regulation can be really useful to regulate. Theory and research can be really useful to regulators.
You mentioned annual reports, and I could only imagine it significantly helping there. I've looked at so many annual reports of regulators from around the world, and the sheer inconsistency, you know, from one regulator to another of what they report and how it leans qualitative as opposed to hard data-based is significant in cases. So I can only imagine that research capabilities would help them really bolster their outcomes with metrics.
Absolutely, and it is both qual and quant. You know, I think the quality of data often gives you real insights into what's happening, and some of the most powerful insights I've had have been from interviewing regulators, inspectors, staff in organisations who are being regulated, or professionals, and patients and members of the public as well. Which often the findings from those things are counterintuitive. And I think in that talk in Dublin, I said that the regulatory staff are absolutely key to how regulation works. And we often focus very hard on writing the policies and procedures and the inspection handbooks and the legislation. But actually, it's what happens in the regulatory interaction between regulatory staff and the health professionals or the organisations that really matters. And they are classically what's sometimes called street level bureaucrats. They have got a lot of discretion in how they apply that regime to the organisation or the person in front of them. And that's really important.
One brief aside here, and it's a nomenclature thing. In North America, at least, and mind you, our audience is from around the world right now, but in North America, regulatory regime is not something we use regularly. So when you say that, what are you trying to capture, or what might be an equivalency that we might use?
To be honest, I'm not sure it's a term that people use a lot outside academia, so apologies for that. The regulatory regime is the set of systems, processes, and policies put in place to enact regulatory purpose. So conventionally, it will include, you know, registering entities. It will then include mechanisms for overseeing their performance, which can be things like inspection, reporting, authorizations, things like that, incentives, enforcement mechanisms, deregistrations, and so on.
Right. That makes sense. And that definitely helps. Now, the idea of developing in-house research capabilities may be very appealing to regulators. However, when it comes to accomplishing that, the question of resources invariably enters the equation. Research done right, as you well know, takes a lot of time, energy, and focus. And you know, just to go back to the GMC, which you mentioned, they are equipped with a considerable research capabilities to execute meaningful research. But many regulators around the world are comparatively small outfits with limited staff and budget, and maybe even a narrow mandate. So what would you say to smaller regulators who may harbor bigger research ambitions?
I think I'd say that there's a lot that you can do. One thing I'd always say is you need someone in-house who's got the lead, if you like, for evaluation and regulation. And they're the kind of the knowledge broker, if you like. With relatively little resource, they can put in place that kind of horizon scanning to find out what other regulators, what research other regulators are commissioning, what research already exists, how do you bring that into the... That's not too expensive to do. Commissioning your own program of research does cost more. There, I think that person, you know, that lead in the organization can build networks. So both networks into the kind of academic communities and the entities that do research, and also networks into other regulators. To build, if you like, the ability to perhaps sometimes commission research as a group of regulators, not just as an individual regulator. In terms of building the links into the community, in the UK, the Professional Standards Authority has run an annual meeting for researchers and policymakers. And I think that's been a really powerful way of getting everyone in the same room, talking about research and evidence and so on. And it has built those relationships, because then the sort of researchers like me in a university, one of the things we spend our time doing is putting together research bids to funders to say, can we undertake this research on? And so if I think about my portfolio of research, a lot of it has been funded by our National Institute for Health Research, which is a bit like NIH in the States. The bids for those have come from me, but they've always had as partners regulators. So if I think of the research we did a large project on the introduction of medical revalidation in the UK, which is for doctors, it's a sort of ongoing checks on their continuing competence to practice. There were lots of reforms in that area in sort of 2012 through to 2018. And we did quite a big project on that. It was not funded by the regulator. It was actually funded by the National Institute for Health Research. And you know, I can't get those bids funded unless I've got really good contacts in the regulatory community. And the regulatory community, I think, you know, can get research done that they don't have to pay for if they've got those academic links. So there's a bit of a win-win there.
Yes, certainly. So I want to build off that a little bit more. So for regulators who leave this conversation today thinking, okay, I'm convinced we need to establish in-house research capabilities. Beyond establishing that internal champion who's going to own and drive it, what are some simple steps they can take to actualize this impulse?
Well, as you say, you know, having a small team internally, but then what do you do with that team? I think you want to get them working on the things that are priorities for the regulator, because you don't want research to be a kind of, it's nice to have, you know, isn't it good that we get a bit of research done, used by your board as a sort of show and tell, you know, oh, look, we've done this research project. So you want to focus it on the things that really matter to the organisation, I think. It's the first thing I'd say. The first step is definitely finding out what research is already going on and networking that and bringing it into the organisation. So getting people to come in and talk about their research and trying, I always say trying when you sort of look forward at the organisation's strategic plan for the next 2 or 3 years to pick 2 or 3 things where you think research could make a bit of a difference, and therefore to focus, because you can't do everything. So you need a smallish number of areas where you think this matters to the organization. There's some research out there that could be useful. We can build some connections and so on and bring it into the organization. So that's one bit. And the other bit would be kind of, as I was saying before, you know, getting out there and talking to other regulators and to the academic community and making those connections. And, you know, the research community, I think on the whole, it really wants to work with regulators. And obviously, if you want to commission research, they'll be saying, well, it costs money. But I think they'll also be interested in seeing their research used. So I hope that helps. It is, you know, you've got to start somewhere, haven't you?
Have you seen any smaller regulators, so not quite of GMC's size, and of their capability, sort of embrace the spirit of this and, you know, adopt some of the, you know, what you just suggested there to sort of make it happen with what they have?
Yeah, so it depends what you mean by small, doesn't it? But I think in the UK, in health professions regulation, we have 9 regulators, and the biggies are the General Medical Council, the Nursing and Midwifery Council, the General Dental Council, and the Health Professions Council, which is a multi-professional regulator. We've then got a number of much smaller ones, the General Optical Council, General Pharmaceutical Council, and then some really small regulators. The smallest regulator we have is the regulator that regulates pharmacists in Northern Ireland only. So that's kind of 2,000 people. So there's a really big spread. I think what's most successful is kind of bringing them together through things like the PSA conference, so that they can learn from each other. But even the smaller regulators, like the pharmacists, for example, they've got a research group, they've got they're tapped into, you know, there's a research community in the pharmacy workforce here in the UK. So there are people in schools of pharmacy who research the workforce, who are interested in issues like licensing, in career trajectories, in reasons for exiting the profession, all that sort of stuff. And so they've got tapped into that network. And I think that's I'd point to them as a great example of a small regulator that's still making progress in engaging with research.
So moving beyond research, and I guess to research, I want to move to some of the great work that you've been doing in your current role at the university. Can you share with us some of your most notable findings or developments from research you've conducted in the past months, year, or years?
Wow. How long have you got? You know, I'll pick a couple of things. And I'm happy, Paul, afterwards to provide some links to like publications and things like that if people are interested in them. So the last 3 years, I said I've spent a lot of time thinking about locum doctors. Is that the term that you would use as well, Paul? Locum doctors, for doctors who are, I think in the States they're sometimes called locum tenens, doctors who are not employed by the organization or contracted permanently by the organization, but they are brought in to work temporarily, sometimes for just one or two shifts, sometimes for a more extended period, often to cover sickness or holiday absence, or shortage specialties where they've been able to recruit permanent staff.
I don't think we'd use that term exactly. I know there's a term for it, but I'm not sure what it is. But I'm sure our audience gets the general premise that you bring up.
So some of our prior work on revalidation, which is the sort of continuing competence system that we've introduced, had highlighted that for doctors who were in a kind of conventional staff relationship with an organization, generally, you know, employed by the organization or contracted for most of their time, the sort of oversight and governance of their practice, the creation of, you know, practice profiles, our equivalents of kind of credentialing information for them, and so on, dealing with concerns, all of that worked reasonably well. But the group we found that it worked least well with was doctors who were not in a conventional employed relationship. And the biggest group of those was locum doctors. There's also been a lot of policy concern in the UK about locum doctors. We've had several examples of poor quality care that have hit the headlines related to locum doctors and to services that have had a very high level of temporary doctor staffing, locum doctor staffing. And there's been a lot of concern about cost, actually, pointing that, you know, employing agency or locum doctors is a lot more expensive than having doctors on staff. So we've done quite a large project, which is just recently finished, trying to understand, you know, how many locum doctors there are and what specialties they work in, what the working arrangements for locum doctors are like, and what are the quality and safety problems, and what might we need to try and change, and what can organizations do to change. And we've just completed that piece of work. Loads of interesting findings. The two things I'd really point to would be, we did a lot of work to compare the actual clinical practice of locum doctors and permanent doctors, and on the whole found very little difference. So there had been a belief that, you know, locum doctors were perhaps less good, less committed, less professionally competent. You know, some people would have said, oh, you know, people who locum, they can't get a permanent job, so that's why they're working temporarily. And we found very little evidence of that, actually. What we did find is that people who were working temporarily weren't all the same. So there were some who were kind of taking a break from their training, sometimes to have a year out, go traveling and do some locuming. There were some who had arrived in the UK as international medical graduates and were getting experience in our NHS before looking for a permanent post. There were some people who were at the end of their career, so rather than completely retiring, they were leaving a permanent job and then doing some locuming. And there were quite a few who were doing it because it fitted in kind of with family and childcare responsibilities. So they were locuming because then they could control their work-life balance. And there was no shortage of locum work. So in a sense, it wasn't that they were, you know, risking their income, because they knew when they wanted a job, they could get temporary positions. So that was interesting. The key determinant of the issues of safety that we found was actually how organizations use locums. So we came out with a set of recommendations that said, you know, if you use locums, these are some of the things you need to do to make sure that they are safe and competent to practice. And they're all pretty straightforward. They're not rocket science. It is about good induction, good oversight, feedback to the locums on their performance, feedback from the locum on what it's been like working in the organization, and those sorts of things. One of the things we did highlight, though, was that when there were concerns about a locum, then those concerns were often not very well dealt with, because the easiest thing to do was simply to kind of terminate their placement or not rehire them. And then they might go on and work somewhere else. So there's some policy questions for us in the UK, I think, about how we make sure if there is a doctor who's working as a locum, whose practice is problematic, how we make sure that that gets picked up and dealt with effectively, rather than them, if you like, bumping around the system, working in multiple organisations. And I'm happy, I'll dig out the reference. The policy report from that has just come out a couple of months ago and is on our website.
Great. Well, taking that question a step further, can you share how any of the the research, the findings have translated into regulatory action or outcomes, or even how it is poised to, because we know the wheels of policy, the wheels of government move very slowly.
It's so hard to do that. I always feel a bit pathetic saying, it's really hard to do that, because often it takes time. And I think actually what I've learned as an academic is that my contribution to regulators is often not mostly about, we did this project on locums, it's found these five things, now everybody should go and do these five things. It's more percolative than that. It is also more about the relationship. And what I find is that regulators will sometimes come to me because I've been around this area for a long time. So, I've read all the books and the research and I know the field, and I can often therefore make sense of things for them. So that's not really about my individual research projects. It's about the expertise I've got because I've spent 20 years, in this as a field. And sometimes, I find myself talking to people in regulatory organizations who haven't been in regulation that long. And, my value is being able to say, back in 2010, that's what was done because of this, and this is what we know about its effects. Benefits of age, isn't it? Not just anything. And being in the field, specialism has a real value actually in academia. The fact that you sit in a field and you know more about it, and therefore you become more useful both to other researchers and also to people like regulators. So it is quite hard to point to examples of things that have changed. I mean, if I give another example, the work we did on revalidation, I think, was useful in persuading people that this new system for assuring competence, it means that doctors have a kind of periodic requirement to be revalidated by their employer. And I think some of the findings from that were definitely useful to the GMC and others in actually defending the introduction of revalidation, because many doctors were not happy about it. One of the things that came out of that was that we suggested that revalidation should be less of a sort of one size fits all approach for all doctors and should be more contingent on things like past performance, things like what field they work in and the level of risk and so on. And that's easy for us to say as researchers, it's actually really hard to do. So I don't think that's really happened. I think they recognize the value of being more proportionate, but actually doing it in practice is hard.
So I want to ask you, you work with data, you're so close to it, you harvest. Yeah. One of my favorite questions to ask people who are deep in research, can you share any research findings you've encountered over the years that have challenged or maybe even reversed your previously held conceptions or convictions about regulation and even healthcare broadly?
So I'll go to the locum one I just spoke about, actually, because when we entered that project, I mean, by the way, as a researcher, I try not to have preconceptions and convictions. I try to go where the data tells me. But we do all have priors, don't we? And I think my prior was actually quite a lot of locum doctors are a bit dodgy, that they are people who can't get on with others. So it may be that their social and soft skills are, not very good, and so they can't hold down a permanent job. It may be that they're technically not particularly competent, so they find it difficult to get a job. So I did go into that project thinking actually a big part of the problem might be the locums themselves and the people who end up as locums. It might be that people drift into that field partly to avoid oversight, because if you're not permanently employed, then you work as a locum.